I am now joined by Sean Tuffy, who's an expert on all things financial regulation related. He has over 25 years of experience in the cross-border fund industry, including various senior roles at State Street, Brown Brothers Harriman, and Citi. And more importantly for me, he has some of the best memes you'll see out on Twitter or X. And he's now on the line with me from Dublin, Ireland. Sean, it's an absolute pleasure. Welcome to the podcast.
Hey, Nate. Thanks for having me. Great to be here.
You know, I love connections like this because we did come across each other on Twitter, and I quickly took a liking to your various memes. I think you know I enjoy posting a few memes myself, for better or worse. But more importantly, over time, I did notice your hot takes on various financial regulatory topics, of course, including one of my favorites, crypto ETFs, Bitcoin ETFs, which we'll get into. But I guess first, just tell us a little bit more about your background when it comes to financial regulation.
Yeah, sure, no problem. So I've been in the area of financial regulation basically since the end of the since the onset of the GFC. So essentially I've been working in Brown Brothers Harriman and the administration arm custody in Europe, and going through what I sort of dubbed the great re-regulation post-GFC. And it quickly became clear we needed to sort of have a clear view on all the regulation coming down the pike and what it meant for ourselves and what it meant for our clients. So I sort of fell into it, if you will. And then I've sort of spent the last decade plus tracking the sort of all the onslaught of regulation that started in Europe, to be honest, and now has sort of come to the U.S. shores lately.
When did you first start posting on Twitter? And was there a FinReg angle from the beginning?
Yeah, it always was a little bit. Actually, I started almost 10 years ago, I guess, a little over. At the time, I was a social spokesperson for BBH, and it was the idea was to sort of engage with the marketplace through Twitter. And sort of as Twitter developed and memes developed, it sort of became a way to communicate around what is admittedly a boring topic. And I find memes a good way to sort of communicate and discuss financial regulation and about as humorous way as possible.
All right. So look, that's a perfect segue because we're going to cover a number of topics, many of which you have tweeted about. And let's just start with the obvious one, which is spot Bitcoin ETFs. And I actually want to read one of your tweets. So this was from January 3rd, before these things launched. So you said, quote, regulated entities selling a regulated ETF on a regulated exchange via registered investment advisors is apparently the future of Bitcoin, and it's never not going to be funny. And I get the sense from that that you're not necessarily the biggest fan of these products. Is that a fair characterization?
I mean, it's a little fair. I mean, I think that tweet was more, as you know as well as I do, and your listeners probably do, there's this ethos around Bitcoin and Satoshi launching this alternate financial system, but ultimately, like, it's sort of become a mainstream asset that's being accessed through the most regulated vehicles imaginable. And I think that's just sort of funny for something that started as trying to reinvent the financial system.
Yeah, and I think that's the aspect. I think a lot of people struggle with that because I think you're right. Bitcoin came into existence after the GFC, and there was a lot of consternation over the centralized monetary system. And so now you have this wrapped into a regulated vehicle. I'm not going to get down that path for our conversation, but I think you're right. I think certainly people struggle with that. Let me ask you this. Regardless of what you think about spot Bitcoin ETFs, do you think the SEC should have approved these, or do you think they were just boxed in with a grayscale lawsuit? Like, I'm curious from a regulatory perspective, how do you think the SEC handled this entire process?
Yeah, so I think if we're being completely honest, the second the CFTC designated Bitcoin as a commodity, the die was cast to some extent. And obviously that was 10 years ago. Futures were approved a few years after that. And the SEC was sort of really running out of road into not allowing the Bitcoins to happen. And certainly the grayscale lawsuit was sort of the final accelerant to the approval. So I think they were sort of boxed in to approving no matter what. I think over the last decade, Bitcoin has gone from being sort of, the, as we talked about, this outlaw asset to probably the most generic mainstream crypto asset imaginable, which is weird for a lot of people to admit. And so I think that the SEC could have always rejected it if it chose to. The political realities, the market realities probably made it impossible.
How do you feel about the fact that the SEC did approve spot Bitcoin ETFs, but there's really no regulatory framework in place for crypto overall? It's almost hard, just if you're taking a step back, to get your head around that.
Yeah, no, I agree. And I would say that's my biggest problem, is that they've approved these ETFs for an asset that is, you know, sort of traded in less than regulated markets with less than regulated entities, and but it is in a regulated wrapper. So I think it is weird to see this approval come through without the triggering framework. But I suppose the U.S. sort of does stuff back to front a lot of times when it comes to this sort of innovation.
Well, so look, so these products obviously are out on the market right now. I'm curious, have you been surprised by the initial response from investors? So I was checking this morning. I show a net $8 billion into these 10 ETFs. That includes over $9 billion in outflows from the Grayscale Bitcoin Trust. And correct me if I'm wrong, but again, my sense in following you on Twitter was that you weren't overly bullish on the prospects for these products. So I'm curious what your initial impression has been of the investor interest here.
Oh, yeah, no, I think I am surprised as almost anybody, I think. I think a lot of people thought that they would grow to be a big deal, but not sort of go as quickly as they have. So I think they've been an unqualified success. I mean, I've put my hands up, the investor demand is higher than I thought it would be. If you looked at sort of pre-launch and sort of the other sort of the BlackRock ETF trust that was out there and other products that weren't really going gangbusters, I assume that those who own the ETF already are Bitcoin already had exposure to it. So I did not expect such a strong start. So I think it's really impressive. And I guess the question will be, as you probably know, in other markets like Canada where these products have launched, there's a quick ramp up and then a plateau. So it'll be interesting to see in the U.S. market if the plateau is just higher given the relative size of the market, or if we're sort of going to see sort of a continued upward trajectory.
Any thoughts specifically on those outflows from GBTC? And I'll color that by saying, you know, it's interesting because they came to market on the day all the other spot Bitcoin ETFs launched with something like $28 billion in assets. And if you look today, I think they're now above that. And of course, that's been driven by the rise in the price of Bitcoin itself. But, you know, there was a lot of chatter around their approach to the market from a fee standpoint. Of course, they're priced way higher than all the competitors. And I was critical of that from the outset. Yeah. But you look now, it looks like a pretty good business move for the time being. Any thoughts on the outflows from GBDC and then just their fee strategy?
Yeah, I mean, I think they've seen substantial outflows, which I think we all expected. Part of it was sort of the closing out of that discount trade when they sort of moved to the ETF status. And I think I expected more, like you, because they are charging a lot more for what is essentially the same product. But I think what I hadn't appreciated is the prices have gone up now to the point where if you're in there a long-term investor, you probably have these unrealized gains, and is it really worth realizing the gains to save the money on the fee structure? So I think that's probably, they probably were smarter than what a lot of people thought to keep their fees high, there, knowing they had sort of a more captive audience. Now, I think the question is, you know, long-term, we probably won't see as many inflows as the money will certainly flow to the cheaper products, but as long as the price stays up and investors don't redeem, then, you know, they have a pretty nice business still.
Yeah, and you almost wonder if that was part of their calculus, right? That they said, okay, we know spot Bitcoin ETFs are coming to market. maybe they had high confidence that there would be this wave of initial demand that we're seeing that would help catapult the price of Bitcoin up. And even though they knew they would have outflows, of course, the price of Bitcoin rising would compensate for that. Who knows? But I could see that being on right. their game board there. Okay, so obviously with the demand we've seen from spot Bitcoin ETFs, I don't think it's any surprise that issuers are now looking to spot Ether ETFs, and I'm guessing salivating over the potential prospects here, given the demand we've seen from spot Bitcoin ETFs. What do you think happens there? Do you think the SEC will approve spot Ether ETFs? Are you watching that at all?
Yes, I'm watching it, and it's weird because, as you know and you've indicated, I was sort of bearish on the SEC approving Bitcoin ETFs for the longest time, probably longer than I should have been. But I actually think the Ether spot ETFs will come sooner than some people are predicting out of the market. And I think the simple reason is, if you read the statements from Gary Gensler around approving the Bitcoin ETFs, the sooner they draw a line under crypto that's been approved by the CFTC as a commodity be put into regulated products, the sooner they can have that line against more meme coins, if you will. So I think it's in their interest to approve it quicker to avoid potential lawsuits, because they're getting sued on like a million fronts right now. So I just think it's pretty easy to stand over and say, look, these are approved commodities, they have futures, there's a marketplace. It's very hard. I mean, they can always deny that they want to. I just think practically they're not going to. But I think that raises the question, how popular will they be with the investing public, as sort of Bitcoin is crypto to, you know, Main Street and retail in a lot of ways, and how big of a deal Ether will be is a bigger question.
You mentioned the CFTC a couple of times already, and I've seen you tweet quite a bit about sort of this jockeying between the SEC and CFTC on regulating crypto. I believe you've called it a turf war. I don't want to go down a rabbit hole here, but can you talk a little bit more about that? I mean, I agree with you, and I think if you look at the prospects for spot Ether ETFs, as you know, we have CME traded Ether futures. That was a huge catalyst behind Grayscale winning the lawsuit and ultimately spot Bitcoin ETFs coming to market. But for people who aren't familiar, I mean, you said maybe the SEC, they'll approve the spot Ether ETF and then try to draw a line in the sand. I agree with that, but I'd love to have you talk a little bit more just about the interplay between the SEC and CFTC on this.
Yeah, no worries. So, I mean, I think the U.S. Is one of the few countries that has sort of multiple securities regulators, basically. And so what you have with crypto is this gray area where does it fall, and the CFTC has sort of about a decade ago decided to be the cool uncle and approve Bitcoin and Ethereum and sort of been more pro-crypto. But they only regulate half the market, so that put the SEC, which has been sort of more decidedly bearish or skeptical of crypto, in sort of a top spot. And so part of the issue, when you look at the overall regulatory of the market, is it's not clear who is responsibility for the crypto market. So there are various bills in Congress that suggest the CFTC should be in charge. The SEC claims it should have sort of primacy, and that sort of really leads to a lot of confusion and creates a lot of this ambiguity that could be otherwise avoided.
Yeah, I 100% agree. I mean, it gets back to what we were saying previously, and you just touched on that there's no regulatory framework in place. Congress has yet to do that for crypto. I think until that happens, we're going to continue to see this turf war. And it actually, I want to move on here because I think we spent enough time on crypto. But, you know, on that note, I mean, any thoughts on, as we look ahead to the future, any thoughts on tokenization and real-time settlement of securities? Because some would say that's where all of this is heading. Now, again, we'll need to have a regulatory framework in place. But do you think that's pie in the sky type stuff? Or do you think that's realistic over, say, the next, I don't know, decade or so?
So I guess we should say that for stuff like real-time settlement, you really don't need the underlying sort of DLT crypto technology, right? Like, you know, there are some markets that are operating T+0 today. You could move there without DLT. But tokenization and real-time settlement have always been put forward a lot as sort of real-world use cases you want for sort of crypto technology, though they haven't really materialized in the last decade, right? So the Australian Exchange sort of famously spent tens of billions of dollars trying to put a DLT solution in, only to abandon it. So I still think we're a while off from any real big bang, real world amplification. I think we'll hear a lot about tokenization of stocks and of funds and of possibly ETFs, but it's always kind of hard to understand to what end beyond just using the technology. So I think it's still a while off before we really see it.
All right. With that, I think that's enough crypto. I appreciate you indulging me on the topic. Let's move on and talk multi-share class structure. And once again, I'm going to read one of your tweets. So this was from February 2nd. You said, quote, "The Bitcoin carnival has been fun, but the ETF share class thing is the actual ETF story of the year." So explain yourself. Why will this be the story of the year?
I mean, I guess it's simple, like, I mean, simple numbers, I guess, is the way I put it. Like, you know, you quoted there's $8 billion in net inflows into the Bitcoin ETFs, and sort of, they're not, you know, it's not insubstantial, but there, I mean, there are trillions of dollars sitting in mutual funds right now, especially in 401ks, and if there would be a way to hook the benefits of an ETF up to traditional mutual funds, it just, you know, such a much bigger opportunity for the ETF ecosystem to expand and continue the progress of sort of the complete ETFization of asset management in the U.S. So, you know, you look at all the tens of thousands of funds, trillions of dollars in mutual funds that could benefit from being part of the ETF ecosystem. I just think it's such a bigger deal.
Yeah, and it's interesting, just over the past week or two, I've seen several analysts within the ETF space say something along the lines that we're talking potentially thousands of ETFs that could come to market as a result of this. And I think the case is clear in that we know retirement plans, so 401ks, 403bs, and such, that's really the last bastion for mutual funds. You know, they're still dominating those platforms. And so what this share class structure would do, it would allow them to keep that lucrative cash cow retirement plan business, but then pursue the much higher growth ETF market. Not rocket science here, but you know, that's high level the case. Let me ask you this. I mean, do you think the SEC is actually going to get comfortable with this structure anytime soon? Of course, Vanguard is using it, but they're only using it for index-based products. I believe all of the filings we have out there now, I think there's 7 or 8, are all for active products. Of course, Vanguard's patent on this expired last May. But do you think the SEC is going to get comfortable with this? I know they have concerns regarding cross-subsidization and one share class supporting the other. What do you think happens
here? So I think in general, the SEC is not immune to having buyer's remorse when they approve stuff. So I think if you were to really get the SEC in the room, they're probably never thrilled that they approved the Vanguard ball in the first place, and probably were happy that a patent protected them from having to deal with this for a number of years. It's kind of similar to, you probably remember when the SEC approved a bunch of levered and inverse ETFs and then stopped doing it for a decade because they had some sort of doubts about that. But I think they will have a hard time holding out forever. So I think they will, you know, the pressure will build. The sort of cross-subsidization of classes, the same concerns theoretically exist for index funds. They're not unique to active funds. So I think that a lot of their arguments are going to fall down under scrutiny. So I think it will probably be eventually a case of them approving it. And I guess it will probably be like we saw with the Bitcoin ETFs, where it will be sort of a batch approval of a number of the applications.
One thing I wanted to ask you about here, and again, I don't want to get too far into the weeds, but when I was at the recent exchange conference last month, there was a lot of discussion around the SEC's swing pricing proposal, which I've seen you tweet about. And, you know, the thought here was that the SEC will want to first push that through before allowing the multi-share class structure. Do you agree with that? And maybe for the layman, can you explain the basics around that swing pricing proposal?
Yeah, so I've heard the same thing. I'm not sure I believe it, but I could definitely see the SEC using it as a carrot and stick mechanism to get some pricing through. I guess the short answer is swing pricing is something that sort of was really developed in European mutual fund space and started life as something called an anti-dilution levy. And essentially, the idea is that if there are large inflows or outflows that could materially impact sort of existing investors and fund prices, the large deals get charged a surplus, so they essentially pay for their own trading that results from the subscription redemption activity. And so regulators, in particular the SEC, have hung on to this idea that it could be a potential way to mitigate the impact of mutual fund runs, quote-unquote, on mutual funds during times of market stress.
So interesting. So I guess just to summarize here, I mean, and not holding you to it, do you think all of this will get pushed through in 2024? Is this more of a 2025 type initiative? How do you see this playing out?
So I think a decision on swing pricing probably gets pushed through before the end of the year. Now, whether it is full swing pricing, which, not to go down the rabbit hole, but to do swing pricing in the U.S., you have to rewire the entire mutual fund market. Why the ICI and others are very against it, because it's a huge effort. So they might ultimately go with what they did with money market funds and just say you have to add a sort of a flat fee on top of funds in the event of huge price surges. But I think they will get that. They are likely to get that done before they make decisions on the applications around the Vanguard model, because there is less pressure on those. You know, that hasn't totally built yet. So it wouldn't surprise me if we don't do those till 25, but the swing pricing decision in 24.
All right, just a few minutes left here. Anything else have your attention in the ETF space? I feel like I've seen you tweet about SMA to ETF conversions. I know you've talked about the quote-unquote ETF tax loophole, which I don't think is going away anytime soon. I know you've talked about ETFs moving to T+1 settlement. I think I saw something on that the other day. Anything in particular have your attention right now?
Yeah, I think the broader macro theme is sort of the continued sort of ETFs eating the world, if you will, our asset management world. So that includes SMAs becoming ETFs. You know, in Europe, the ETF market is smaller by comparison, but growing. And so they're having their own discussions around the share class models, which I think are worth paying attention to if you're sort of, especially a U.S. manager looking to enter into the ETF market space in Europe. I agree with you. I like to make fun of the tax loophole, but it's not going anywhere anytime soon. And I think the other interesting thing to sort of pay attention to is how, since the sort of COVID market stress at the, you know, in early February, March 20, regulators have become much more amenable to ETFs and their structure and how the sort of the market-based structure and how they are resilient to sort of market shocks, which is sort of a very good positive for the industry, which spent, you know, a decade being accused of potentially being a huge systemic risk.
No, I love that last point. I mean, I've talked a lot about that, and obviously not just from a regulator perspective, but obviously end investors as well. I think what we saw during the quote-unquote COVID crash and then the Fed coming in, buying bond ETFs, all of that made both regulators and investors so much more comfortable with the structure. But Sean, we're going to have to leave it there. I really appreciate you taking the time. This was a lot of fun. Glad we could connect. I'll tell you my one goal moving forward is to ensure that you don't turn me into a meme on Twitter. So hopefully I can achieve that. We'll see. But thank you for joining me.
Thanks for having me. It was great.
That was financial regulation expert Sean Tuffy.